Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is a Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Emilio San Pedro, and in the early hours of Tuesday, the 6th of August, these are our main stories. The U.S. Special Envoy Zalmay Khalilzad says significant progress has been made towards a deal with the Afghan Taliban. In a rare intervention, the former U.S. President Barack Obama has urged Americans to reject the language of hatred, fear, and racial intolerance from any of their leaders. A decision by Delhi to revoke the special status given to Jammu and Kashmir has provoked anger in the Muslim-majority state and in Pakistan. Also in this podcast, 9 works of art taken by the Nazis are finally returned to their Jewish owners by the German state of Bavaria. And
when you picture visiting a Category A prison,
Norwegian nature,
you don't really imagine blueberry woods and silver birch trees.
We take a tour of what's been dubbed the world's most humane prison. We begin in Doha, where talks between the U.S. and the Taliban are making progress, according to the U.S. Special Envoy Zalmay Khalilzad. The two sides have been attempting to craft a peace deal to end the fighting in Afghanistan, organizing a withdrawal of U.S. troops in exchange for security guarantees. Zalmay Khalilzad, very positive then. Just where has the progress been made? A question for our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, who's in Doha.
The fact that he has left Doha is a very strong signal that they are on the home stretch. In negotiations of this time, the most difficult, the most sensitive issues are always resolved by talks, direct talks between the heads of the delegation. In this case, it would be Zalmay Khalilzad on the American side and Mullah Baradar, who heads the Taliban delegation. So Zalmay Khalilzad feels that the biggest obstacles seem to have been overcome. He spoke of technical discussions, the mechanisms and steps regarding the implementation of the agreement. Our suspicion is that they will want this agreement to be announced in Washington so that it is an American deal, but that there will be a signing at another time to be followed by Afghan talks, because that is a key part of this deal. It is a U.S.-Taliban deal, which involves a phased U.S. pullout of its troops in exchange for Taliban guarantees that Afghanistan will not become a safe haven for extremist groups like Al-Qaeda targeting American interests. But there's two other parts, and that is that Afghans have to start talking about the future of the country, a roadmap for peace, and there has to be an eventual ceasefire. So it's a four-way agreement, and they seem to have made progress on the first part of it.
And how could this impact the Afghan presidential election next month?
That is the red button issue, Emilio. Exactly right on the mark, because there are many Afghans, including almost pretty well most of the presidential candidates, except for the current president, Ashraf Ghani, who are saying, what's the point of spending money, wasting money, they would see it, on a presidential election when peace should be the priority? And there are certainly many in the American administrations who say the same thing. And they're hoping that once this U.S.-Taliban deal is signed, once the Afghans themselves sit down for formal negotiations, that this will eclipse the importance of a presidential election. But there are those who support President Ghani who say, well, he needs a mandate. We can't let Afghanistan's electoral process be eclipsed by this peace process. You can have the two of them at the same time. But at some point, there's going to have to be really tough discussions, because many Afghans believe there's no point in a presidential election right now.
Lise Doucette. The former U.S. President Barack Obama has called on Americans to reject the language of hatred from any of their leaders. The rare intervention came after President Trump sought to deflect criticism that his anti-immigrant rhetoric had fueled violence. We can and will stop this evil contagion, is what Mr. Trump promised in a televised address following the 2 mass shootings which left 31 people dead in Texas and Ohio. While he put forward a series of measures to prevent mass shootings, he fell short of supporting gun control measures.
We must reform our mental health laws to better identify mentally disturbed individuals who may commit acts of violence and make sure those people not only get treatment, but when necessary, involuntary confinement. Mental illness and hatred pulls the trigger, not the gun.
President Trump also offered his condolences to Mexico for the loss of at least six of its citizens in the El Paso attack and condemned racism, hatred, and what he called white supremacy. I asked our correspondent in Washington, Barbara Plett-Usher, for her assessment of Mr. Trump's performance.
It was a particularly strong condemnation given his history. He condemned racism, bigotry, as well as white supremacy. So it was in unusually direct terms because, as you said, he's previously played down this idea of a white nationalist threat. Bear in mind, of course, that he is facing these accusations that his own anti-immigrant rhetoric is fueling this kind of violence. And on top of that, you have this manifesto believed to have been written by the El Paso shooter, which echoed some of his rhetoric. So he has chosen to adopt a different tone, although he didn't address his own remarks from the past. And he also blamed all of this on violent video games and social media.
Yes, he blamed mental illness, video games, even the news media, or the fake news, as he calls it, for this behavior. What about gun control? Any sign of moves in that direction?
Well, in his televised remarks, he did focus more on the reform of mental health laws than on gun control, really. He said it's a mental illness and hatred which pull the trigger, not guns. So one of the main steps he outlined was what are called red flag laws. This is a way to better and more quickly identify mentally ill people who shouldn't be allowed to purchase firearms and then to confiscate their weapons if they do. But earlier, you know, he had tweeted that he supported stronger background checks, which is something that gun control advocates have been asking for. But he didn't mention that during his statement.
Now, as you said earlier, Democrats, especially those seeking the party's nomination for the presidency, were very critical of him in the wake of the El Paso shooting in particular. What will they have made of this address by Mr. Trump?
Pretty quick criticism, frankly. They said he didn't have a coherent plan for addressing gun violence. The presidential candidate Cory Booker basically said this is a really weak, ineffective soup of words. And the two top Democrats in Congress, Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer, in particular, were upset that he didn't mention those background checks. The ones he had tweeted about were not mentioned in his televised remarks because they have passed two bills in the House of Representatives to strengthen such checks, but these are stalled in the Republican-controlled Senate, and Trump has threatened to veto them. So they basically said it just showed that he wasn't serious and that he was a prisoner to the National Rifle Association and the gun lobby.
Barbara Plett-Usher in Washington. What then is the most effective way to counter gun violence in the United States? The BBC's James Kumarasamy spoke to Dr. Cassandra Crifassi, assistant professor at the Center for Gun Policy and Research at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. First, just how many guns are there in the country?
We have at least 270 million guns in the U.S., and some estimates put it even higher than that, such that there are more guns than people in the United States.
And why is it an estimate?
The way that we regulate gun purchasing and ownership in the United States makes it so that the federal government cannot keep track of how many guns are being purchased or who is purchasing them. There's a ban on the creation of a registry that would allow us to know both how many guns there are and who owns them. We have created a system in the United States where we have two ways that you can buy firearms. You can go to a federally licensed dealer, you can undergo a background check, submit your information, and you can buy your firearms. But in about 30 states, if you don't want your name associated with that purchase or don't want to undergo a background check, it is perfectly acceptable under federal law to buy from a private seller who is under no obligation to check your background.
So is that where the focus has been in terms of calls for Congress to pass background check laws to make those background checks universal?
That's a common theme that we're hearing now in the call for policy change. And it makes sense. If you want to buy a gun from anyone, you should undergo a background check. The challenge is that background checks by themselves aren't sufficient to move the dial on gun violence. We've done some of the most rigorous research looking at background checks, and there are some challenges with reporting. There are some challenges with implementation. In contrast, states that have taken it a step further, and in addition to requiring background checks for all sales, if they complement that with a licensing system, that's really where you see protective effects. We see reductions in firearm homicide and firearm suicide when you complement background checks with a licensing system.
President Trump called for a reform of mental health laws. He said mental illness and hatred pulls the trigger, not the gun. Is there any evidence to back that up?
So if you look at all of the interpersonal violence that is caused by people with mental illness, it's about 4% of interpersonal violence. They're far more likely to harm themselves through suicide or to be the victims of violent crime. And so we should absolutely, yes, be strengthening and addressing gaps in our mental health system. But that alone is not going to solve the problem.
Is this all about politicians and who funds them? That's what you often hear, that there is a wide support in public opinion for tighter gun control, but politicians simply do not feel that they can go against the gun lobby, which is funding them in many cases.
You have, for a very long time, a group of single-issue voters who were voting against reasonable gun policy. They would call their leaders, they would call their politicians, they would show up and vote, and they would vote against people who passed policies. I think we're starting to see a shift in the U.S. where folks are showing up on the other side. They're becoming single-issue voters for gun safety policies.
Dr. Cassandra Crifassi talking to James Kumarasamy. The German state of Bavaria has returned 9 works of art to a Jewish family from whom they had been taken by the Nazis. The Bavarian authorities said it had taken a long time to find the rightful heirs. Oliver Berlau reports.
The artworks, 5 paintings, 3 color casts, and an ivory relief depicting scenes from Schiller's ballad The Bell, had been confiscated by the Gestapo in November 1938. The owners, Julius and Semaya Franziska Davidson, were later murdered in the Theresienstadt concentration camp. The authorities in Munich said that because of the Holocaust, no children could be found, which is why it had taken such a long time to find the rightful heirs. The Bavarian culture minister, Bernd Siebler, called the return of the artworks, which had been stored in the Bavarian National Museum and the Geographical Collection, an important contribution towards coming to terms with the horrors of the Nazi regime. The heirs thanked the Bavarian authorities for what they called an act of justice.
Oliver Berlau. You're listening to the Global News Podcast on the BBC World Service. Still to come.
I'm from Belfast and it really has become a symbol of the city. It's got 2 famous yellow cranes. They kind of tower over the city. So when you kind of drive into the city, it's like, I'm home.
Northern Ireland's historic shipyard Harland and Wolff, which built the Titanic, looks set to close. But first to Jammu and Kashmir, where Delhi's decision to revoke the special status of its only Muslim-majority state has provoked anger. The wider Kashmir region, split between India and Pakistan since partition in 1947, is claimed by both countries. Until now, though, the state has enjoyed a relative autonomy, including the right to make its own laws. In a moment, we'll hear about reaction in Pakistan. But first, as Yogita Limai reports from Delhi, the announcement of the move caused chaotic scenes in the Indian parliament.
A day that will change the course of Kashmir's history. As India's Home Affairs Minister announced the region's special status was being revoked, there was an uproar in Parliament. There was no vote on the subject. The constitution was changed by a direct presidential order. For 70 years, Kashmir has had more autonomy than any other state of India. Because in 1947, it was given the choice of being part of India or Pakistan and chose the former on the condition that it could make its own rules except on matters of defence, external affairs and communications. Today, politicians from the region, like former Kashmir Chief Minister Mehbooba Mufti, say they feel cheated.
Today is the blackest day of Indian democracy and we, the people of Kashmir, you know, our leadership who had aligned with India with great hope and rejected two-nation theory, it seems that, you know, we were wrong in choosing India over Pakistan. Even the parliament is letting us down.
She's been detained and other Kashmiri leaders are under house arrest. Tens of thousands of extra troops have been deployed in the region. Internet and phone lines have been cut. People aren't allowed to hold meetings, rallies, or even gather together in public places. Before today, only Kashmir's permanent residents were allowed to own property in the state. Now, anyone from India can. Many are accusing the ruling BJP of serving its Hindu nationalist agenda by changing the demographics of India's only Muslim-majority state. But the party's national spokesman Nalin Kohli says the decision was designed to better integrate Kashmir's residents with the rest of the country.
I think this is a move really for the people of Jammu and Kashmir. It is to ensure that they enjoy the same rights and they get the same benefits.
It was one of Prime Minister Narendra Modi's big election promises. But the manner in which it was done has left many questioning the state of democracy in India.
Yogita Limai. For its part, Pakistan has reacted angrily to the decision. Shafkat Mahmood is the country's education minister.
Well, this is obviously, according to even their own constitution, this is an illegal act because any such change in the Article 370 or revoking it cannot be done without the approval of the Kashmir Legislative Assembly, which they have tried to bypass. So it's completely illegal, anti-people, but it's not going to achieve anything because the resistance of the Kashmiri people will continue. It has been there for a very, very long time. Every Kashmiri hates the Indians, and these kinds of illegal chicanery was not going to get them very far.
The Pakistani Education Minister, Shafkat Mahmood. Suvir Kaul is professor of English at the University of Pennsylvania and is from Kashmir.
The Education Minister of Pakistan is right in talking about the fact that a great many Kashmiris, Kashmiri Muslims in particular, are deeply alienated from the Indian state. They've been out on the streets. Enormous numbers of them have been wounded, killed, tortured, maimed. And the repression that the Indian state has unleashed in Kashmir, in the valley, has been extraordinary.
Does that mean, though, they want to be part of Pakistan or do they want independence?
No, I am categoric in my understanding. And I say this as somebody who visits Kashmir and lives with a great many of my Kashmiri Muslim friends. An earlier generation might have, in the period 47 to maybe even 1955, 1960, identified with Pakistan because it was meant to be the state that offered the resolution of Muslim nationalist aspiration in South Asia. But since then, Pakistan has played such an ugly role in the lives of Kashmiris on their side of the border by sponsoring insurrectionary elements in India in the name of financing freedom fighters, but making sure that any Kashmiri grouping, militant grouping, that identified itself with the search for independence was actually put down, was murdered by groups that were more Pakistan-identified.
So Kashmiris have become geopolitical pawns?
They have been for the longest time. For 70 years now, Kashmiris, the Valley of Kashmir, has been a simple geopolitical pawn in a game being played by powers much larger than them.
Suvir Kaul speaking to the BBC's James Kumarasamy. To Northern Ireland now, where the historic shipyard Harland and Wolff looks set to close after more than 150 years. At one point, the Belfast company employed more than 30,000 people. It's perhaps most famous for having built the Titanic, but it's now down to just 130 employees. Morgan Eyre has more.
Harland and Wolff has been in trouble for some time now, probably decades in fact. In recent years, they've suffered huge losses going into the millions of dollars. And the government, they're not intervening this time. You know, they're saying it's a commercial issue and they say that it conflicts with the EU's state aid rules. It was, as you said, a very, very prolific shipbuilder. Its workforce has seriously dwindled to 130, as you said. And it has really tried to diversify into the oil and gas sectors and do repair work, but has struggled to compete with other major shipbuilders, particularly in East Asia. And at the moment, it doesn't look like anyone will step in the 11th hour.
But this closure goes beyond money.
Exactly. I'm from Belfast and it really has become a symbol of the city. It's got two famous yellow cranes, Samson and Goliath. They kind of tower over the city. Like, I suppose it's the equivalent of the Eiffel Tower or the Statue of Liberty. So when you kind of drive into the city, it's like, I'm home. You know you're home. And it's 150 years old and it's played such a huge part in Belfast's history and the economic growth. It was a huge employer. So sadly, it looks like the gates will have closed for the final time.
Morgan Eyre, what can we learn from what many foreign media have dubbed the world's most humane prison, Halden Prison, in Norway? 20 years ago, the Norwegians moved away from a punitive lock-up approach and sharply reduced the number of inmates who reoffended after release. Our reporter Emma Jane Kirby has toured Halden's facilities.
It's so lovely around here, isn't it? It's so beautiful.
It's really, and it's really calm.
When you picture visiting a Category A prison,
Norwegian nature,
you don't really imagine blueberry woods and silver birch trees.
This is a place for all the fathers.
Normalizing life behind bars, not that there are any bars on the windows at Halden, is the key philosophy that underpins the Norwegian Correctional Service. Four times a year, for example, prisoners who pass safeguarding tests can invite their partners and children for a sleepover.
I'm stunned. It's a proper house. There's a kitchen and a sitting room and bunk beds for children. I can see a cot. There's even a play garden.
Mm-hmm. But they need help. A lot of help.
Prison officer Lynn Andreasen recites the founding tenet of Halden Prison. The purpose of incarceration is not revenge but rehabilitation. And even though the inmates here are murderers, sex offenders and drug smugglers, they should be treated as much as possible like any other Norwegian citizen. As the prison governor, Ara Hudal, explains, the whole point of the Norwegian justice system is to get inmates out of it.
Welcome in.
The punishment in Norway is to take the freedom from them, but the other rights they still have.
This is a garage. We have a car workshop.
The 258 prisoners at Halden get the opportunity to go back to school or to learn a trade while inside.
And you have to go to school for 4 years, and then you can go out and be a car mechanic.
Many walk out through the gates as fully qualified mechanics, carpenters and chefs. Their day starts at 7:30, and they're not locked back into their cells until 8:30 at night.
It's been very hard for me to accept what I have done. I have taken someone else's life, and the first couple of years in prison, I really struggled with this act I have committed.
Fredrik, who's serving 15 years for murder, says keeping busy has saved his sanity, while his newly achieved graphic design diploma means he now has something to offer back to society.
So if they don't have opportunities and you just lock them in a cage, they're not going to be good citizens.
Governor Ara Hudal insists Norway's low reoffending rates show it's money well spent.
In Norway, we focus a lot on recidivism. Because,
repeat offending.
Yeah, repeat. Because in the 80s and early 90s in Norway, we had 60-70% recidivism. The Norwegian government decided we have to do something about that. And today, the recidivism rate is 25%.
Wherever you go in this all-male prison, you'll hear a lot of female voices. 50% of the prison officers at Halden are women. Lynn Andreasen again.
Makes the environment more calm.
In the arts and crafts workshop, inmates John and Khan agree the high presence of women guards has improved prisoners' behaviour.
I think that women guards keep the macho guys down.
It's good to have the female touch. And it would be good for men to go back to society and have that same contact with women as they should have had outside. So it's good.
That report by Emma Jane Kirby. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. And if you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Emilio San Pedro. Until next time, goodbye.